to order. And we will start, just so you know, committee members, we will not be holding a work session on House Bill 2785 today because the amendments are back in LC to be reworked. So we've scheduled that for a work session on Monday. And I will open up a first public hearing on House Bill 3245. Kat, will you please provide us with an overview?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3245 directs the Water Resources Department to issue a certificate for a water conservation device or system that meets department performance standards, and it creates a certification program for installers. It creates a resident and business tax credit for purchase of a certified water conservation device and installation by a certified installer. The bill applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2008, and sunsets January 2nd, 2016.
Thank you, Kat, and we are honored to have Representative Reed here, who's going to give us a brief overview on the bill as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Tobias Reed, State Representative of District 27. Thanks very much for having a hearing on this bill. I wanted to applaud your efforts thus far. I think there are several examples of the sort of innovative and far-looking policy that you've adopted so far, and I hope that this bill could begin a discussion of a similar sort of concept. And I don't think it's any stretch to talk about the importance that water plays in our quality of life and what our state is going to look like in the future. And I wanted to begin that sort of a discussion of a mechanism that could encourage the use of new technology and techniques to conserve one of our most precious resources. I grew up in Idaho and made the drive from Boise to Salem countless times. I went to school across the street at Willamette, and thinking about the differences in the western and eastern parts of the state, we think of ourselves, I think, as a very rainy state, but that's not always true. And even in places where it is, there are a lot of opportunities to be smart about conserving water. Can have a big impact on what our state is going to look like. So this is a work in progress, I think. You'll notice a lot of blanks in the bill in terms of what a tax credit might be. But I am not so naive as to say that I am the expert on what the systems or technologies are now or will be. But I think it's a concept that deserves some discussion, something that could have a big impact on where we go. And I appreciate the opportunity to begin that discussion. So thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Great. Thank you so much, Representative Reed, for bringing this forward. And I also see that we have another committee member who's a co-sponsor on the bill, so I don't know if you wanted to add any thoughts on that?
No.
Okay. I think you've said it all.
For nature of those comments.
Okay, I think I will invite the department up, and if you would like to stay for a few minutes.
Thank you. Really quick, Madam Chair.
You want a quick question?
Well, it's not a question. I'm trying to get over the fact there is actually a Democrat that came out of Idaho.
Governor Andrews.
Yeah, just clarifying.
Is that making you worry, Representative?
It is. They're closing.
And he's a very tall one, too, if you haven't noticed already. Try cycling with him.
I'd like the representative to note there are no Democrats moving into Idaho.
Had to go somewhere.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to ask the Department of Water Resources, Water Resources Department, come up. I see Debbie's here. Actually, Representative, I was disappointed that you didn't use the acronym of how you coined this bill, which is the WETC. We had the BETC and the RETC,
right.
So he felt it was important that we have a WETC.
Heard it here first.
Yeah, you heard it here first. On that note, thank you, Debbie.
Madam Chair, for the record, I'm Debbie Colbert with the Water Resources Department, and I've provided some testimony. I really just wanted to just acknowledge that the Water Resources Department thinks that water conservation is going to be one of the key tools for meeting our future water supply needs, one of several, and that this kind of approach proposed by House Bill 3245. The incentive-based approach seems to hold a lot of promise. We have a lot of questions about, as written, you know, what kinds of devices would be included, how many, and because we, as an agency, would be responsible for certifying them and certifying the installers of the devices, it would have a fiscal impact on us that's not included in the governor's recommended budget. But we do appreciate the concept for providing this kind of a tax incentive for installation of these water conservation devices. I'd be happy to take any questions.
I'll start off with the questions, Debbie. Is there, in your knowledge, and actually we happen to have somebody from the National Conference of State Legislators in the back of the room, but I won't embarrass him by bringing him up, but I'm curious if you know of any other states that have a similar incentive program already in statute.
Madam Chair, I don't know offhand whether there are other states that are using a similar approach. And in fact, since we have been reviewing this bill, we've been on a steep learning curve because we don't have any existing water resources programs and through our department that are related to tax credits. So we've been trying to get a better understanding of these tax credit approaches as they relate to water.
Okay. I do know you probably are aware that under the RETC, the Residential Energy Tax Credit, for instance, on water-efficient washing machines, I do believe that you can receive a tax credit through the RETC. I don't know what the whole range of other water-efficient appliances. It sort of goes under the guise of energy efficiency, but also falls within the water-efficient range as well. But that's the only one that I know of that we have currently.
Yeah. And Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think that this does lead to some very interesting discussions about what kinds of devices would qualify and how does it relate to existing building code requirements and other tax credits. But it's a very interesting concept, and I think it's a good discussion to have.
Okay. One last question regarding, and maybe this is something I might ask the Farm Bureau to come up, but as far as for irrigation equipment, my understanding is that there are some tax credits in place to incentivize, for instance, to upgrade irrigation equipment that's more water efficient. And so that's something that I don't know if you can answer, but certainly we might want to have. Would you like to come up, Katie, and address that?
I'm going to have a follow-up on your question.
Okay. Representative Burley had a question first.
I'll defer to him since he has a follow-up
okay.
on yours.
Thank you.
Representative Dingfelder, members of the committee, for the record, Katie Fast, Oregon Farm Bureau. And I had already signed up to testify, but I'm happy to come up early. Conservation is a key piece of meeting our future water needs, and we're implementing conservation practices on farms now. I'd like to add, I think for a statewide strategy for Oregon, this is also tied with water reuse and water storage that you're going to be hearing about later today. For agriculture, we're currently participating in similar programs with the Pollution Control Tax Credit Program and the Business Energy Tax Credits. But what we're doing now for efficiency for irrigation is, drip irrigation, smaller nozzles on sprinkler systems, in irrigated systems with open canals. People are starting to line those canals to reduce leakage. So that would be one issue through the rulemaking or better lined out in the bill to make sure that these current practices that people are implementing in their operations would count for this tax credit. Along with that, I do have some concerns about the certified installer and that there would be an additional cost for farmers to participate in the program if they were forced to be pushed into a certified installer where they could do some of those installation costs probably in-house with their current employees who are familiar with the irrigation equipment. So the ability to kind of work through a current farm business management system would be important to be added to the legislation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And let me start off by saying, Representative Reed, I really appreciate this legislation. I really like this approach. Following up on the Chair's question, is the tax credit in addition to the write-off that a landowner, if it's a business, is going to be able to take on their Schedule C. So, for example, if you put in a piece of equipment, in this case a water conservation device, you're able to write it off in your Schedule C as either materials or equipment. Does this tax credit in addition to that?
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't have an answer for that. I mean, this is part of our department getting up to speed with how these kinds of programs work. But and I don't know if there's anyone here today from revenue or that might be an expert on those types of questions.
I would just point out, if you're a CPA and you buy a pencil, it's tax deductible. If you're a farmer and you buy irrigation equipment, it's tax deductible. And so I'm curious if this would be in addition to the tax deduction you're already receiving for the capital equipment purchase.
Representative, that's an excellent question, and since this bill has a referral to revenue, I would imagine they would have to make sure that there's no double dipping happening. So. Thank you. Do you want to add anything else while you're up here?
I think those are, basically the comments I would have made earlier. So I will add one piece, is that we are facing challenges on getting these projects funded right now. EQIP, through the Federal Farm Bill Program, it's the Environmental Quality Enhancement Program, is one avenue that farmers and ranchers have been utilizing for water conservation projects. That is increasingly challenging to dip into those funds. They're very competitive, as well as a very long grant writing process that requires a lot of technical assistance to the farmer or the rancher when they're making those grant applications. So, this is another opportunity, another funding level for them to look at, and might help them with some of their, matching costs for EQIP type grants. So,
thank you. Don't go away because Representative Burley had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got several, Madam Chair, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, just to make sure that I'm clear, this bill does have a subsequent referral to the Revenue Committee, but if I'm not mistaken, it does not have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So how then do we deal with the fact that the Water Resources Department in their written testimony said this will require a substantial increase in department resources? That sounds to me like it's a fiscal impact.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Revenue Committee would have to make that decision on whether to further this legislation.
Okay. Debbie, the notion of a water conservation certificate, this is a new creature. Is that correct? This is something we'd be creating through this, that such certificates don't exist already?
Madam Chair, Representative, that's correct. This would be a new certification program for those kinds of devices.
Okay. And I also, Katie, I was interested in your comment about the certified installer requirements, because when I was reading that, I was a little bit curious, how that would actually be implemented. How do we make that actually work on a day-to-day basis? And the question I had was, given the business energy tax credit, the residential energy tax credit, and some of these other types of similar credits, are we being consistent in how we're setting this program up? So, for example, under Betsy and Retsy, do we require certification of people that install some of this equipment? I think that we should try to be consistent in policy issues like this. They're very identical, and so, if it's working over here, let's capitalize on that and try to make sure this is working the same way.
Unfortunately, Mike Greeney, if he was here, could answer that. But my understanding is Betsy, which is, I'm very familiar with, does have certification requirements, and I would imagine that the drafters looked at that when they were drafting this legislation as well. But I think that's a really good point. We want to make sure that it's consistent in all the programs the state has.
That was all the questions I had, Madam Chair. Okay.
Representative Jensen?
Yes, I have a number of questions, if I may, Madam Chair.
Fire away.
First of all, Debbie, can you name some water conservation units or devices or whatever we're going to call them here to help me with a little bit of understanding?
Madam Chair, Representative, The bill defines a water conservation device as a device or system that operates to reduce use of water. So based on that, we're assuming this could be things like low-flow toilets for in-house, possibly the low-pressure sprinkler system, such as what Katie described in her testimony. So it's as written, it seems pretty open-ended, and I think that would be part of what we would have to figure out is narrow that or define it more specifically and use examples from other energy tax and other systems.
Follow-up. With this particular line, is there any retroactivity in here?
Madam Chair, Representative, in my reading of the bill, it would it wouldn't be retroactive, and it would start in the tax year, I think, 2008.
With all due respect to my good colleague from Heppner, I have a certain amount of heartburn with this, and especially in relationship to the agriculture and farming community. And that heartburn comes from the fact that many of the irrigators, the agricultural users in my area, have long ago implemented some efficiencies in the use of water, and you mentioned the low-pressure irrigation rather than the high-pressure sprinkler systems that they had, much more efficient, much smaller quantity of water to get the same result. The drip irrigation, which you mentioned, that there are a couple of major operations in the good representative from Heppner's district where drip irrigation is present. And this is a heartburn issue for me, Madam Chair, because not only have these people paved the way then that you want to give other people who haven't made those changes in the past, that could have made those changes in the past, a tax credit for doing what my producers did out of their own pockets with no visions of a tax credit. Now, this thing compounds, as far as I'm concerned, because my producers in eastern Oregon, also when it came to some of the negotiation for the use of water and for irrigation rights, one of the things that we have been looking at, that ODF&W and the federal people have been looking at, is this fabulous little term of mitigation. And many people have got mitigation credits for installation of devices that my producers got zip for. Not only did they not get tax credits for, but they didn't get any mitigation credits for it. So, to go too far down this path, leaves me with some major type of heartburn on the issue. And if I may follow on that particular item, Madam Chair, I don't know. I'm remodeling two bathrooms. Am I going to want to wait until this bill is enacted before I put the toilets in those bathrooms so I can claim a tax? I got a third one, so I'm not going to be critical on those. And maybe I could afford to rent a porta potty in order to get those. I mean, those low flow toilets have. I think at this particular point they're pretty much difficult to impossible to buy anything else than that type of thing.
Please don't invite me over your house while you're.
Pardon me?
Make sure and don't invite me over your house while you're remodeling.
I hope, Madam Chair, that this law, if this goes into effect, act, if this were bill were to be enacted, that you would put at least some kind of an emergency clause on it so that it would be completed prior to the roundup, so that when some of my friends from the legislature come to Pendleton for the roundup, that I'd be able to have everything up and running at that point.
I think that's noted for the legislative
I
record.
I retract my comments. I'm with you.
And I want to share a little bit of the concern about the contractor on this. I'm not sure where this is coming exactly from, but I have been now for more than 2 years. Most of the work and remodeling and things in my personal, if I were going to go into, some conservation, I would probably do the installation of it, whether that's an energy device or whether it's a water saving device. So the idea of having to go out and hire a contractor at conservatively in my area, if you get a cheap one, $55 an hour, just, pretty soon I've got a negative effect as far as the tax credit is concerned. Or technically. The third, another item with this, Madam Chair, and I simply...
Anyone want to yield their time to the witness?
I have had trouble now for 10 years or 8 years at least in a caucus that I sit in, because they want to turn around every time I hear of them doing something, they want to give somebody tax credits. They don't want to raise any taxes, but they want to give tax credits. And now I come in and we've got another group of people come into the building. And, I'm hearing them want to give tax credits.
You're welcome back in our caucus.
Oh, no, he's not.
And there is a distinct difference between a tax credit and a tax deduction for something. And there's a very distinct advantages to the tax credit type of thing. So... With all respect to all of my colleagues and to the two very charming and intelligent ladies who are at the dais there now, I am a real advocate of conservation. I have for a long time said that water is the most precious economic commodity that we have, period. Without water, we have nothing. And we have a finite amount of water, and the only way that we can deal with our growing world and populations is to conserve. I mean, that's very simple arithmetic for me. So I'm a proponent of conservation. But I have some grave concerns about legislation where we give tax credits, and I have concerns about, I have to have concerns about my constituency who have done many of the things that are being advocated and got nothing for it, except to feel good. And a little bit lower electricity bill to pump their water up the mountain, but okay. Thank you.
Anything else, Representative?
I could
have. Yeah, I'll take that back. Thank you, ladies,
Thank
very
you.
Much. Next, I'm going to call up Jim Foyenga, did I get that right, from Eugene Water and Electric Board? Jill. Oh, sorry.
Jill Foyenga.
And also Jeff Sandberg from the City of Portland. I'll have the municipal perspective up here. Thank you, Jill. I apologize for massacring
right.
your name. I get it all the time, so I certainly sympathize. For the record, can you please state your name?
Sure. My name is Jill Hoyenga from the Eugene Water and Electric Board. I'm a water management specialist. I've been doing residential as well as commercial industrial water conservation program development and implementation for 11 years for Eugene Water and Electric Board.
Thank you. Welcome to the Capitol. Thanks for coming here to testify today.
Thank you. I just want to mention that I cannot speak to agriculture, but I can speak knowledgeably for urban uses of water. And our agency, Eugene Water and Electric Board, as well as myself, really support this legislation for a number of reasons. I'm going to read the first paragraph verbatim, and then I'm probably going to arb out from there. Water conservation has some similarities with energy conservation efforts, and the Oregon Office of Energy has led the way with energy tax credits, particularly in regard to adding water factor requirements to listed residential tax credit listings. I want to say that Oregon's water factor listings are unique in the nation. It's actually unique in North America, the only other place that has added a water factor to the criteria until recently was the nation of Canada through their Office of the Environment. That model has actually been used by Energy Star recently. When energy conservation options are exhausted, more generation can be built, and as you know, we cannot generate more water. As demand in Oregon increases in all categories of use, our best options are to shift water from non-beneficial uses to meet our new water demands. And that the state is the steward of the waters of Oregon. And the state has been very proactive, and I think needs to continue to be proactive in assuring availability of quality water supplies. And, you know, there's a difference between water supply and a quality water supply, and I want to make sure and emphasize that. A successful shift from non-beneficial use takes considerable time. In Eugene, we've been at it for 11 years, as I said, and we are just now being able to rely on that shift as a source of supply. So the time that it takes is important. I think it's a disservice to the citizens of Oregon to wait until an emergency in order to act. The Federal General Accounting Office issued a report a few years ago. I was unable to find it in the time frame I had available to prepare, but I can provide that report if you're interested. But it reports a funding gap for water infrastructure maintenance of billions of dollars nationwide, and the state of Oregon water utilities are not unique in that need. Most of our infrastructure, there was a huge build-out after the war. That infrastructure is about 50 years old and is reaching its useful life and needs to be maintained and replaced in order to assure reliability. I'm sure that you share the water utilities' value on reliability and serving water to our customers. So what we're faced with is, are we going to build infrastructure to meet new demand, or are we going to build infrastructure to replace existing aging infrastructure? And it really does come down to a trade-off because water rates are low, and people do not tolerate large increases in the water rate that would be required in order to do a both-and. In order to build to meet demand, and to replace our water infrastructure, our aging water infrastructure, would take, it was estimated last fall in EWIB, 25% increase in water rates. That's intolerable. I think that's not okay either, partly because water is crucial to life, and we cannot price it out of reach for the average or poor citizens. We just can't do that in a moral way. The state water conservation tax credits would be a tremendous help to water conservation efforts in the urban sector statewide. Many water utilities, especially the water utilities, already have rebate and other efforts underway. But water is cheap. I like to say the only thing cheaper than water is air. Both are necessary to life. And therefore, when I go into a facility and say, there's these really great water measures that I have for you, and it's going to cost this much, and there's a 15-year payback because water's so darn cheap. It's just not an attractive option. So a tax credit would be a very good addition to our program offerings in order to get people to move sooner rather than later, to get people to move either until the price goes way up or there's a water emergency that prompts them. I'm going to turn to the second page of my written testimony, in which I presume to make some proposals about administration of this tax credit. And you've already mentioned Betsy and Retsy as models, and I think that's a very important thing to pay attention to. But I wanted to bring your attention to a low-cost administration model that is resident in the state of Oregon under the Cross-Connection Control Program. The Cross-Connection Control Program currently is one FTE. I believe it's the Department of Health. They kind of changed departments recently. And there are some corollaries when I went through this bill that are directly related or can be associated with the administration of the cross-connection control program that you have here in the state of Oregon. By the way, I am a cross-connection specialist. I'm an instructor for tester certification for testers and specialists, and so I have a pretty keen knowledge of the rules since I teach them. Last time was in March that I taught a class. So in under Section 4 of this House Bill 3245, under performance standards for devices and systems, the state cross-connection program relies on the University of California Hydraulics Research Lab for testing. They test and certify a very rigorous testing schedule, and then they publish an approved list according to their criteria. The corollary support for the Water Resources Department implementation of this legislation would be the U.S. EPA WaterSense program. This is a program that's been 4 years in development and just began being implemented on the shelf in January 2007. I've included additional information on the certification process that the WaterSense program is using. It is a product labeling program similar to Energy Star. And being held, the WaterSense program certification process is being held to a much higher standard than Energy Star at this time. Both are being administered by the U.S. EPA, but the Energy Star is administered by the the Office of Air and Radiation, whereas WaterSense is being administered by the Office of Water. The WaterSense program will be a third-party certification process, whereas the Energy Star program currently accepts manufacturers' claims to energy savings for their documentation and labeling. The U.S. EPA was directed to start the WaterSense program in response to the GAPS report by the GAO that I referenced earlier. The second point I wanted to highlight, and by the way, I included the entire OARs for the cross-connection in the supplemental material. The second one I wanted to highlight was the contractor certification. There is an equivalent program in the cross-connection control program. They train water utility personnel to oversee those local backflow testers, and the certified contractors would be the equivalent. And also, the backflow tester certification can be earned by employees of companies. The other corollary was Section 11, verification of purchase and installation. Again, the corollary in the cross-connection control program would be that the cross-connection control statewide relies on trained water utility personnel, trained and certified, I might add, who do the inspection, verification, and assure that testing is done on an annual basis. So not only overseeing installation, but overseeing ongoing protection. And in this case, in many cases, the water conservation equipment, it needs to be installed properly, but it also needs to be operated properly on an ongoing basis. And so that's why I think utility involvement is important and should be considered in this case as a corollary to the cross-connection control program. And the other thing I wanted to point out is that there is a water conservation certification. We call it water management certification at this time. It's being developed by the Pacific Northwest section of the American Water Works Association. We are currently developing a partnership with a community college to administer that training, and we are also going to be having the first training in May of 2008. So there is training, a certification that would be a direct corollary with the cross-connection specialist training currently available and required by the state in the cross-connection control program. I want to thank you for your time today, and if you have any requests for further information, I'd be happy to help you. I have my phone number here and other contact information on the letterhead. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much for coming here today. I think we're going to hear from the City of Portland, then we'll take questions. Thank you, and I'm happy to have my city here, and we're probably, what, the highest water and sewer rates in the state? If
the highest, Madam Chair, the highest sewer rates. The
right.
Water rates are average.
They just happen to come in one bill.
I have
so,
to
you
make
know.
That point or I'll yeah. be in big trouble.
Okay.
So. I am Jeff Sandberg. I work for the City of Portland Water Bureau. I coordinate the commercial program that provides outreach to our business sector and helping them reduce water use. The first part of my testimony really has to do with how important conservation is, but I think that point is well made, and so I'll skip that part. I did want to give you one quote from Sandra Postel, who is the author of Lost Oasis, where she says, "Doing more with less is the first and easiest step along the path toward water security." And water security is really what we're talking about. In Portland, with the city environment and our water system, we face water demands coming from lots of different directions, new industry, population growth, as well as potential warming of the planet, which will mean longer summers, less storage capacity, and certainly, Oregon itself faces challenges in providing water. And my experience is to actually work with different companies. I go on site, and I find just a tremendous amount of opportunities for improvements in water efficiency, all the way from toilets to complicated manufacturing processes that could be improved. And one of the things that I see when I go out there is sometimes we'll do a joint audit or survey of a building, and we'll be working with a contractor that's being supported by the Energy Trust. And so the building owner will look at the Energy Trust, and they'll be making all these energy improvements, and they're getting these tax credits, and then they'll turn to me and say, "Well, do you have anything for water?" And we don't have anything for water, and so often those improvements that are specifically related to water don't get implemented. So often it's the payback is too long, or just the extreme cost to replumb or repipe are the roadblocks to conservation. I think that financial assistance like this bill has proposed can tip the scale, can encourage and motivate individuals so that they will make changes in water efficiency that they need to. And as I mentioned before, there is a tremendous amount of opportunity. There are new irrigation systems that take out the human factor that will make great improvements, but they're expensive. There are still very wasteful, archaic water cooling systems that could be improved if the financial motivation was there. Thank you.
Thank you so much, both of you, for coming, and it's really good to hear from folks in the field who are doing this every day. Any questions for this panel?
Madam Chair, just a comment, which is what the thing I take away from both your presentations is that the fact water is as cheap as it is to our urban customers means that the payback period for water conservation efforts is very, very long, which gives not a lot of financial incentive for folks to take the kinds of steps that you're suggesting. And I think that's where the potential credit, at least in the urban setting, could be useful. I think this is certainly a very interesting topic to continue to explore, and I appreciate you raising that particular issue with us.
Thank you. Thank you for being here today. Appreciate your input. Great. And last we have Amanda Rich from the Special Districts.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon. My name is Amanda Rich, and I'm here today representing the Special Districts Association of Oregon. And I have very little to add to what you've already heard from the municipal perspective. I would just say that over the last 10 years or so, water utilities across the state of Oregon have been working very hard on water management and conservation plans and increasing conservation. As you know, I believe that Jill passed out in her packet mm-hmm. the Division 86 rules that govern those water management and conservation plans. The plans themselves and the rules that govern them acknowledge the fact that conservation is a critical component of our future water supply for this state. And I guess I would just posit that water utilities are doing everything that they can within their control, within their own system, and also in trying to provide incentives for folks to change their behavior. It's very hard to practically control the efficiency with which the end user uses the water resource. And so any tools that we can add to that overall toolbox, I mean, providing incentives for people to change their behavior, I think we're definitely worth exploring, and we'd be very supportive of that. So with that, I'll end and take any questions if there are any.
And I have a quick question. I haven't seen the data I've seen now is maybe 4 or 5 years old.
Mm-hmm.
But do you have any sense as to how many cities now, or water providers, I should mm-hmm. say, because not all cities are water providers, are using a stepped rate as an incentive for water conservation? Versus a flat rate or an inverted rate?
I don't have exact data. My sense is that most of your larger water providers are using graduated rates or stepped rates. And I know that there are a lot of educational programs going on around the state through another client I represent, Oregon Association of Water Utilities. They're continually providing education to their smaller utilities in terms of ways to both sewer and water of doing graduated rates and setting up rates that provide incentives for people to conserve. So, but I don't have the exact answer to your question.
Yeah, if that's something you could provide the committee.
Okay.
Because I know there was a survey done at some point, but I think it's now at least 4 or 5 years old. If you have that, I think that would be helpful, just information. The department may have that, too, through their water conservation plans. I think they require that rates that water's mm-hmm. being charged is reported as part of this plan. So,
of course, some of those are still rolling in, so we don't have all of the plans yet. But I'll see what I can do in finding that information for you.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions for Amanda? Okay. Representative Jensen, do you have a quick question? We've got two other bills on the docket.
No, I just was wondering how many teachers she's willing to spend.
How many teachers I'm willing to spend? Oh, don't do that to me.
All right, I won't. I'll withdraw the question.
Question withdrawn. Thank you,
Thank
Amanda.
You. Can I escape now?
Yes. Quickly. Gavel's coming down. Representative Reed, would you like to come back? Any closing comments before I close the public hearing?
Just briefly, Madam Chair, members of the committee, thanks for holding the hearing. I think the range of comments that came from experts from around the state really underscores the importance and potential in this concept. And as I said at the beginning, I didn't mean to suggest that this bill was ready to go in any respect, but I think it does deserve the consideration and some thought about it. And one thing that had occurred to me, and I just throw it out there as an option, is to potentially amend the bill to talk more about a study to further investigate the options that this concept could have, to work with the department to figure out the options and the mechanisms and so on. So we can perhaps talk about that offline, but I appreciate having the hearing and beginning to talk about the issue.
Well, thanks. Thank you again, Representative Reed, for bringing this forward. As you know, it's a very important issue. I've been working on water conservation issues for about 20-something years, and very pleased to see that there's some other, legislators interested in this issue. I think it's an important issue for us to discuss, and I think you have a good suggestion. Representative Jensen,
he's going to ask you the
same question, so be careful.
I want to merely comment, and I want to commend Representative Reed for bringing the conservation type of bill forward. I do think it's important, and I do appreciate you come from an area where it's as important in where you grew up as it is in the area that I represent. But before you get carried away with trying to amend the bill or wanting to amend the bill for a study, there's a time and a place for a study, and sometimes there's a time and a place for action. I'd like to have you, consider that and think about that a little bit, before you procrastinate with a study sort of thing. I think there's a lot of merit here, I'm raising some things that are, objections or concerns that I have with it. Not that I have a concern with, what is the intent is. At all, and I think it's something that certainly warrants moving ahead. I do think we have to look at how much can we afford.
Certainly,
there is going to be a significant price tag that goes along with this, and in terms not only of the management of it, but also in the implementation through the credits and those are going to come at the expense of something else, whether that expense of something else is the expense of the taxpayers in Oregon to, divvy up more money, for it, or whether it's going to come reduce services someplace else. But be that as it may, the concept and idea and the intent of what you have is something that I think has great merit, and I do applaud you for it. So,
thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Jensen. I appreciate that. I hope we'll be able to work together on it.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3245, and I will open up a public hearing on House Bill 3473, and Representative Cannon. Pat, can you give a brief overview, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3473 allows school districts to enter into intergovernmental agreements with other school districts to aggregate district energy requirements for the purchase and delivery of utility services as one entity in order to qualify for lower industrial rates.
Thank you, Representative Cannon. You want to...
Thank you, Madam Chair. It is so good to be in front of a friendly and familiar committee. Hi.
Mostly friendly, anyway.
Thank you. Yeah, very friendly. Thank you for hearing this bill. I'm here really just to introduce a constituent, Courtney Wilton, who brought this bill to me. I think this is a great example of one of our public servants, a business administrator for the David Douglas School District, looking around the country at what some innovative states are doing, looking at his own district and the way they're spending their money, and trying to find ways to possibly save taxpayers' money and extend the services of the teachers and educators in his district, which includes about 10 homes in my legislative district. The David Douglas School District, I think, has one block within the boundaries of my legislative district. So with that, I think I want to turn it over to Courtney to explain the intent of the bill. I think you'll hear in subsequent testimony both some concerns and also suggestions about potential revisions, and I look forward very much to having a conversation about where we can go with this. So with that.
Great. Thank you, Representative Cannon. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 3473. My name is Courtney Wilton. I'm the business manager of the David Douglas School District, and we're a district of about 10,000 students, completely in the city of Portland, in East Portland. And we spend about $1.5 million a year in energy costs, so that's about $150 per student. And I think that's probably less than average just because our schools are pretty much all at capacity. So if you do the math and you look kind of at statewide, what would that total be? I think it's upwards of $100 million. So it's a lot of money, and it's unfortunately it's increasing pretty significantly along with energy prices. Last summer, as Representative Ken mentioned, I actually saw an article in a Business Manager journal, of all things, of a program in, I think, the state of Indiana, where school districts there had aggregated their energy consumption, and by doing that actually got a better utility rate. And I thought, that's kind of a creative idea. I wonder if we could do something like that in Oregon, hence the legislation.
And I guess that's the gist of it is, you know, is allowing school districts to aggregate their consumption and by doing that get a better rate. Is that a radical concept? And I don't believe it is. I think there's you know, I'm not at all an energy expert, and I think there's all sorts of questions over, you know, what does aggregation mean? Does it mean aggregating by district? Does it mean, you know, being treated as one entity or one meter? There's issues of if you do that and get this special rate, you know, is there a subsidy, in which case, you know, other people are paying more. I actually think if you looked at the effect of doing this on other consumers, it would be just very minuscule, and that people would actually support this if they knew that the end result was you know, significantly lower rates for the school districts. But that's my opinion. I've been in my current job for about 10 years, and you know what I've noticed is every legislative session there's a real fight to increase school funding as much as possible, and I know it's a real struggle for the legislature, and I don't envy you. At the same time, I see once that increase is established, I see so much of it, you know, as a business manager, I see the checks and pay the bills, and I see so much of that increase getting eaten up in general cost increases and very little of it reaching the classroom. And so, you know, in terms of helping the classroom, I think there's kind of two aspects to that. One would be to try to obviously maximize the funding, and then the other would be to try to control your costs as well as you can. And I see this legislation as being consistent with that and consistent with a lot of the efforts that the legislature has made, you know, in recent sessions, you know, with PERS and health insurance and also energy. I mean, the 1149 has been tremendously helpful for us and allowed us to do a lot of energy-conserving projects that have absolutely saved us money. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, as one business manager proposing an idea like this, you know, similar to someone at tilting at windmills, I think it is. On the other hand, I don't make any apologies. I think we need to think about things like this. And if something like this isn't the answer, I'm hopeful there, you know, we'll continue to look at this and try to find ways to save school districts money so they can deliver more services to the classroom.
Thank you. Thanks for coming today. We really appreciate it. And are there any questions for either of the panel members? Representative Burley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Courtney, I'm curious whether or not you have actually tried to enter into such an intergovernmental agreement, but found that you couldn't for whatever reason.
I haven't. And I think that I don't think there's a single school district in the state that has done that.
Okay. Madam Chair, comment. Mm-hmm. Though I absolutely unequivocally agree with your arguments and the fact that this is a very could very well pay dividends down the road, I would submit perhaps that this might be redundant. I had asked my school district folks what they thought about it, and their comments came back, and I'll read this. It seems redundant with the general authority to enter into intergovernmental agreements local governments are granted in ORS 190.010. So I would...
Would you like to read that for the record?
It is a little bit long, but 190.010 is titled Authority of Local Governments to Make Intergovernmental Agreement. And so I would ask that you might want to take a look at that and see if that already meets your need.
But I think there's more than just that issue in that. I think obviously there's the ability to enter into an IGA, and then there's also the ability to be, if you did that, to be treated as one consumer versus 200. And mm-hmm. And I think that's the second part, which I was proposing as well.
Right. I entirely agree. All I would ask is that you look and see whether or not the existing statute allows you to already do this, so we're not creating a redundant statute.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Next, we'll have Rick Willis with the PUC. Actually, why don't we have also Betty Merrill from Department of Energy?
Nice tie.
Is that like the bullseye right there that they get?
Madam Chair, I hope not.
I'm just complimenting your time.
Yeah, it's very nice. Thanks. Thank you, Rick. For the record, whoever wants to start first.
My name is Betty Merrill from the Oregon Department of Energy. I'm the manager of the Building Technology section, which deals with public buildings and a lot of K-12 programs.
And I'm Rick Willis with the Public Utility Commission.
Do you want to start with your amendments?
I can. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I met yesterday with Representative Cannon to discuss this a little bit. And as written, the commission has some concerns about the bill in that it, as it's written now, what it would call for is school districts, number of schools within that district, each with their own separate meter, to be treated as one large industrial customer, which is now one big facility with one meter going through it. In my conversation with Representative Cannon, we talked about the possibility that what this was trying to achieve was allowing school districts to aggregate for the ability to purchase energy out on the open market under old Senate Bill 1149. And I have shared with Representative Cannon some proposed language that would help achieve that. And what the language does is just that, make it very clear that school districts, and they can probably do this now, but make it clear that school districts can aggregate for the purposes of going out on the market through direct access and getting contracts for power through that mechanism. And so I've supplied proposed amendments for your consideration.
Okay. Question I had, unless if I'm hearing you right, so you're saying that they have the ability to do that now?
Madam Chair, probably so. Under the Senate Bill 149, mm-hmm. they can probably do that now. Now, I don't know what iterations districts have to go through so they can pull these intergovernmental agreements together. That part I don't know. But on the energy side, Senate Bill 1149, I think, allows them to do that currently on the energy side.
Okay. So we're still not clear if this language is absolutely necessary in order to do that.
Madam Chair, perhaps I can try to clarify. There are a couple of different possible purposes of this bill. And I think, as Rick mentioned, as written, this bill would allow school districts to do something that they currently can't do, and there is no way they can do it, which is to qualify for industrial rates. Mm-hmm. No intergovernmental agreement will allow a school district to qualify for an industrial rate. The PUC has concerns, and I think that's what Rick is alluding to, about allowing school districts to do that. The amendment that the PUC has proposed would allow school districts to aggregate for the purposes of buying power on the open market under 1149, and that may not actually, that may be some a power they already have.
Yeah,
but as written, this bill would give school districts a new tool.
Okay, thanks for that clarification.
Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Cannon has now raised a question in my mind. I guess we're kind of talking about two pieces to this. One, yes, they can already aggregate and buy power under 1149, mm-hmm. but the second part, if I understand what my colleague is saying, is that this in and of itself doesn't allow them to qualify for the lower industrial rates, and if that's the case, how does an entity qualify for lower industrial rates? What do you have to be?
Let me turn to my colleague. Excuse me, Lee Sparling. He's the head of our utility program, and Lee knows this stuff better than anybody should.
And for the record, Lee, can you please state your name and position?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lee Sparling. I'm director of the utility program at the Public Utility Commission. In response to Representative Burley's question about what it takes to qualify as an industrial customer, we'd be talking about a customer who is served at one site and is large enough to qualify for that particular rate schedule. It might be a customer who is using more than any one school district facility right now is using. And what this bill would do is it would say that instead of each of the school district facilities being served under the smaller customer schedule at individual sites, that we would instead treat them for billing purposes as if they were one large customer at one particular site. that's an ability that those customers don't have now. As Rick Willis mentioned, the customers do have an ability to aggregate and go out and buy power in the market from other suppliers. That might allow them to get some benefits from aggregating their power needs, but in terms of the delivery charges, even direct access doesn't allow them to consolidate and get power charged as if it's delivered to one site. Even if they go to direct access, they're still having the power delivered, and they pay for delivery to each of the individual sites.
Follow up?
Mm-hmm. Follow up.
Thank you. Lee, thank you very much. That's very helpful. The large enough to qualify, though, and you may not be able to answer this right off the top of your head, but I'd be curious, how much are we really talking about? You know, what's, I mean, some actual numbers, and would we... you know, if you were to take either the Portland Public Schools or Ben Lapine Schools, I'd be curious if you took their entire power consumption right now and measure that against the minimum threshold to qualify for an industrial rate. I'd be curious to see where those two stack up. Would that make sense?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, we haven't done that calculation. There are, for any utility that we regulate, a variety of rate schedules depending upon size. My understanding is that many individual schools are of the size of 50 to 100 or maybe 250 even for a large school, kilowatts. A large industrial customer may be well over 1,000 kilowatts, maybe well over 5,000 kilowatts. We could do some sample calculations of what a typical school district might look like if it were aggregated in this sense. We haven't done that, and I have no idea, can't give you any kind of an estimate right now as to what the savings might be or whether, in fact, there necessarily are savings.
And one last follow-up. Thank you. And then we also wanted to kind of get your thoughts. So, you know, Rick was talking about with the industrial users right now, it's one site, one meter. If we were to go this direction with this bill where you now would have various sites with various meters, from the practical on-the-ground implementation aspect, how would that work? Would that be difficult or not?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, it could be simple or it could be hard. If we simply took the amounts that are billed to each school district facility and added them up and then refigured what the bill would be, it could be fairly simple. But there are some complications due to the fact that school facilities use power at different times, and depending upon the time when they're used and how that all adds up, adding things up, if they really were one customer, the bill might be lower. But when you're just adding the different peak usages, you may not be able to capture that diversity effect. So I'm sorry I gave you a complicated answer to that, but it does get complicated if you really want to treat them like one facility.
Yeah, and if I just quick comment on that, the reason I was asking that is because one of the things I think we need to consider as we deliberate this is whether or not there's going to be a fiscal impact to the school districts if they physically have to re-meter, for example, to make something like this work. So maybe if you give that some more thought as this moves along and come back with some of that information.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for the PUC?
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I came to testify on behalf of Michael Graney and the Department of Energy. We've been working with David Douglas School District, and I've personally been working with Courtney for about 8 years. I commend him for looking forward, and they've been working hard on energy efficiency in their district and making some really big strides. So him looking forward and trying to come up with a mechanism to save his district funding is admirable. When I first read the bill, my first reaction was I picked up the phone and phoned Courtney and said, "You can already do this." And I was looking at the aggregation piece. The Oregon School Boards Association, the Oregon Department of Energy, Willamette Educational Service District have looked at aggregating school districts for purchase of power in the open market. We've also looked at aggregating for the purpose of purchase for the state buildings. the issue with aggregation of any loads to buy on the open market is very complicated.
Right.
And because we are governmental entities, the procurement, in order for us to get our ducks in a row and be able to consummate a contract within the time frame, which is about 1 week, is very difficult. The other issue is what your risk is. We have looked every year since 2001 at rates on the open market, and the risk to us did not outweigh the benefit. So aggregating to get a lower price on the open market is a good thought. Trying to pull it off is very difficult. It's very complicated. School districts have a load that's relatively short number of hours of operation. They're working during peak hours, 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. Pretty much everything goes off. So to get a good price on the open market, you really need the same load 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. So what you need to do as a school district or another entity to be really a prime candidate for someone to want to offer you a good deal on power is find somebody who'll match your load. And to date, we haven't been able to work any deals to find anybody who uses the power the opposite kind of times a day that we do. So those are my comments.
Any questions? Representative Cannon.
Yeah, and this may actually go back to the PUC a little, although I think you're all really good in this field and can all probably take a stab at this. My understanding is that, let's say the bill passed as written with this trigger of or qualification for lower industrial rates, meaning not the open market power that we think they already have, purchasing power, but actually a different rate class. I guess I have two questions. One is the degree to which the concern that you just raised about the peak load issue and the fact it's not spread throughout the day, the degree to which that is concern if you're an industrial customer or doesn't help if you're an industrial customer. Could you address that?
Well, I think in terms of going out to purchase power, you look at what the rates are, okay, and you look at what's being offered. The folks who are offering the rates look at your load. That's somewhat dependent on what rates you're going to get.
Mm-hmm.
So would it be that they get the ability to do it and nobody'd sell them power? I don't know. That's something for the PUC to talk about, because I'm not sure.
Representative Cannon, if we're talking about the utility serving the customer, the aggregate of the school districts, instead of talking about direct access, as I said before, it's a little hard to say how much savings there might be, because the large industrial customer schedules are designed for customers who tend to operate at what we call a high load factor. They use pretty much the same amount of energy with not a lot of variation. They use it throughout the day. For a customer like the schools, and even an aggregate of the schools, they have the kind of load pattern that Betty just mentioned, where they have peaks during the day and not much uses the rest of the time. That may not fit very well with the large industrial customer schedules, and so I question really how much savings there might be.
Okay, a follow-up question. So suppose that the PUC... May
thank you.
Suppose that the PUC did make it possible for, and the legislature made it possible for a school district to qualify for a lower rate, some sort of industrial rate, and it was in fact going to save the school district money. My understanding from my conversation with Rick yesterday is that the PUC would have to help the utility find other ways to make up for that, the loss that they would be experiencing from the school district, which would mean adjusting other rate categories, raising other rate categories. Is that a fair characterization of the way rate setting worked?
Kara Burley, Representative Cannon, the short answer is yes. That rate change may not happen immediately, but the next time the company is in front of us for a general rate review or a general rate case, we look at all their costs, what we expect those costs to be, and set rates so that across all customers those are recovered or likely to be recovered. So if the schools are paying less than otherwise, then yes, that amount will be picked up in some manner from all the other customers.
And final follow-up very quickly. Is there any way of getting a sense of and we're talking so hypothetically, is there any way of getting a sense or modeling what, you know, decreasing utility rates for schools or school districts would mean for other customers? I mean, I guess I'd love to get some concreteness here if we really do continue to go down this path.
Chair Burley, Representative Cannon, we'd have to work with our utilities, which would be Portland General, PacifiCorp, and Idaho Power Company, to get some better data on how many schools they serve, how much of the total amount of service they provide, and in order to work out some kind of an estimate like that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's an innovative idea, but I think, as was said by the PSC, this is a very complex issue. And the notion of just looking at the industrial rate, I don't think completes the picture. And I didn't catch your name.
Representative Smith, my name's Lee Sparling.
As Lee was saying, we also have to look at the delivery cost of this power. And that could be quite significant. And here's the question I actually have. In 2003, the state of Oregon was experiencing a tremendous energy shortage. I think it's 2003 or 2002 when we had tremendous drought. And if I remember at that time, that power delivery is based on priority. And I guess my question would be, is in times of an energy shortage, if we experienced another event like we had, is in 2002 or 2003, who takes priority in delivery of power? Is it residential, commercial, or industrial? And if you've committed yourself to being an industrial purchaser and power becomes in short supply, what do you do with the school?
Chair Burley, Representative Smith, I wish that were a rhetorical question because that probably gets even more complicated.
It is complex.
As a general matter, if industrial customers were to get any kind of a discount, and that has happened in certain circumstances, in those circumstances they would have a lower priority for priority of service if there were that kind of power shortage that you were describing. For the most part, though, the utilities practices with respect to which circuits, which customers get turned off if there's a need for rotating outages or anything like that, that depends on what facilities are on each particular circuit. It's hard to target individual customers because you need to look at who's on the entire line. So the commission has tried to use the practice of giving lower priority to those customers who are paying less for an equivalent service. Whether that would play out in the same way for schools if they were aggregated in this way, I can't say at this point.
If I could follow sure. up. And please know, I have no idea how the energy market works. What about the feasibility? And it probably isn't, though, but let me ask it anyway. What about the feasibility about allowing an aggregated group of purchasers to buy directly off the grid rather than having to go through a utility? Would there be potential savings there?
Chair Dingfelder, Representative Smith, that is the direct access mechanism that we have touched on throughout this discussion a little bit. That is basically the opportunity for an individual customers or a group of customers to say, I don't want to buy my power from Portland General, my local utility, if that's the case, but instead I want to buy from a marketer or another utility that can provide the service to PGE service territory, and then PGE would deliver it to my individual sites. That's an opportunity that is allowed under SB 1149 from the 1999 session.
Because I want to inject a question at this point. What if a aggregated school district had that opportunity to enter into that type of agreement, held their cards close, the price of power dropped to a point where they thought it was a good opportunity for them to enter into a long-term contract? Then is there the financial feasibility to make this work and to cover the delivery cost? And I know we're throwing out a lot of assumptions on this.
Chair Dingfelder, Representative Smith, for the most part, direct access hasn't saved anybody a whole lot of money yet. The reason for that is because the legislature did a smart thing back in 2001, and it said 1999 when it established the restructuring law. And specifically in 2001, it said that any customer can come back to service from the regulated utility at a cost of service rate. It didn't throw people out into the market like happened in many other states that are regretting it now. One of the consequences of that is that we've had to design the process so that when somebody leaves, they don't leave a lot of costs behind for other customers to pick up. And as a result of all the procedures we put in place to guarantee that, it hasn't really paid off to go out to the market. So some customers have done it, but for the most part, they're not saving a whole lot by doing so.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, if I could
And then we're going to have to wrap up because we have a whole other hearing to hold.
Just because there's not enough complexity in this issue yet, another factor to consider is what happens when these school districts that aggregate are in several different utility districts.
Mm-hmm.
One's in PGE, one's in Pacific Core, maybe another one's in a municipal. How does that work? I'm not saying it can't, but it's another issue that needs to be worked out. And the final issue I want to mention is that we're more than happy to work with Representative Cannon and the committee on this bill. Let me just say that the language as it's written now, we don't think accomplishes what we're talking about today, in that the language simply says that these school districts can aggregate. It doesn't say that the utility must provide the utility at that discounted rate, or the commission must approve those discounted rates. So just an issue I bring to your attention to work.
Great. Thank you. And thank you very much for being here today. And I know that you'll be working with Representative Cannon as we move forward with this. Thank you. And finally, we have Tom O'Connor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Tom O'Connor. I represent Oregon Municipal Electric Utility Association. OMEU is an association of the small municipally owned systems in Oregon. With regard to this bill, it was difficult to interpret because of the way it's drafted, but let me try to make this as short and as clear as I can for a history major talking about electricity delivery. We would certainly have no objection to the amendments that Rick Willis has proposed. If those amendments were adopted, that would mean that a school district within our service territory could aggregate their energy load and come to the elected board and request that the utility deregulate its services. To date, no one has done that under 1149. None of our systems have done that under 1149 because the costs are actually higher in most cases to go out on the market than they are for our service. The part that we have a major heartburn with over the way this is drafted and is the issue of providing service to multiple entities over 1 meter. And you've had some discussion of this. It's basically that what would drive the costs up to the rest of our ratepayers significantly is if you had a situation where you have 30 meters, all with individually different energy uses, and you forced the utility under this to provide service to that group of 30 meters as if they were pricing it for 1 meter. And you just can't do that under a cost of service mechanism without driving up the cost. For example, I wouldn't want to sit here and say all rates are done strictly on a pure cost of service base, because they're not. I mean, there's some adjustments in there. But particularly what we're all about as consumer-owned utilities is we got to provide this stuff at the cost to provide it. And that means, so your energy, your bill has a couple of components. It has the cost of the energy what we call the energy, which in this, in for us, would be the cost of our purchased power from Bonneville. That's just the energy. But the other cost, and it can be significant for rural utilities in particular, is the distribution costs. And those are the transformers and the lines and the metering and the billing. And those distribution costs are what we're concerned about. Is if this bill were to drive us to force us to serve at a, you know, as one customer under one meter, a large industrial customer, the reason they may have a cheaper rate is that they may be taking power at a higher voltage. The utility may not even be providing the transformer that they need. The industrial customer may be providing that. Some very large customers do that. But in the case of other entities, the utility, meaning the rest of the customers, are providing those transformers that step that power down to what they need. And so, again, we would have to... It's not just as simple as combining it under one meter, because the costs are different, and so that's the chief concern we have, and that would need to be addressed.
All right, thank you. Questions?
Just a quick question.
Quick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Even if you took the Portland School District and aggregated them, would they still consume enough energy to even qualify to be an industrial user?
Madam Chair, Representative Dingfelder, I just don't know enough about the Portland School District to say. It depends so much, again, on not just the pure size, but also the demand. You know, are they going to peak? What hours are they going to peak? How much, you know, the steel mill in McMinnville, for example, has tremendous peak when that arc furnace goes on. You know, those kind of costs you all have to factor into the rate. A lot of our, I should say, in talking to my utilities, most of our school districts are already on the large customer rate. I mean, because we're so small. I mean, in the way our rate structure is such. But again, it's a rate applied to each meter. It's not trying to take 30 meters and bring it into one and apply the lowest rate to that. That's the key.
And you had a follow-up?
No, I mean, I guess just a comment. In my district, I have a lot of large food processing facilities, and some of those, who I know very well because of the financing I do with them, they don't qualify for industrial rates. And so I'm trying to imagine the amount of quantity that would have to be purchased to qualify. Just thinking out loud. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Well, I think Representative Cannon will be sitting down with many of the parties here, and we'll see if...
That's a neat idea, though.
Let's
get this off.
Yeah, we'll see if we can come back with some amendments.
With
that, I'm going to close House Bill 3473, and I will open up a hearing on House Bill 3203. I will invite Willie Tiffany and Katie Fast to come up. And I'm going to call people up together. Actually, and how about Dan O'Brien? Yep. Because we need to be done by 5:02. We get kicked out of this room.
Well, try to be as brief as possible.
Okay, thank you. Those are great words.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Willie Tiffany with the League of Oregon Cities. Happy to be joined by my good friend Katie Fast with the Farm Bureau Federation, but we are also here on behalf of the Water Resources Congress, the Special Districts Association, and the Oregon Association of Nurseries. And really what this bill does and how this coalition came together was this last interim when the department was putting together their conservation and supply initiative. These five associations kind of very much supported that effort and kind of looked what would be the next step. If that effort was successful. And really, that next step is for the local entities. Once the department does a statewide needs analysis of conservation and supply opportunities, the next step is for the individual entities to do their own feasibility, look at environmental impacts, and try to cite actual projects, whether they be reuse, conservation, or supply projects. And Katie will talk a little bit more about the specific kind of projects we're talking about. What this bill does is establish a fund within the Water Resources Department to help folks with those upfront costs, whether they be environmental impacts, needs analysis, hydrologic analysis, those types of projects. Those, again, are really the barriers for many small projects out there. It would allow an entity to apply for a grant up to $250,000, and that $250,000 would have to be matched, required matched, by at least 50%. So capped at $250,000, 50% match. It's funded through the sale of lottery bonds. We're asking for a $5 million contribution within this bill to establish the fund. We are also working diligently with our federal counterparts, our delegation in particular, on a federal match. And we do have an appropriations request in this fiscal year at the federal level. And then lastly, I just want to, there is a piece in the bill that may be a bit confusing. Both departments are here, but we established the fund to be financed through the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department, but issued through the Water Resources Department. And it's very, very similar to the way the state operates the Safe Drinking Water Fund, where the state's financing entity is the Economic and Community Development Department. They have that expertise, but the Water Resources Department has the real expertise about when and where and what types of projects with relationships to water should be cited across the state. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Katie.
Okay, and I apologize that our committee administrator didn't get to give her overview, but I think Mr. Tiffany did a good job, so in my rush to make sure we get through this bill. Go ahead, Katie.
And thanks, Chair Dimfelder. For the record, once again, Katie Fast, Oregon Farm Bureau. As Willie mentioned, during the interim, as we talked about storage and supply with the Department of Water Resources, this group of organizations came together on other discussions regarding what's the next step. And I think we felt some pressure from our counterparts in Washington and looking at the investments that the Washington State Legislature has made in water supply initiatives in the state above us, that we started looking at Oregon and what would be an important program for Oregon. And as we reached out and started having those discussions with our constituents, this issue of the pre-planning process came up as an area where Oregonians have a gap on getting projects moving forward. And from talking to my members in the farming community, there were some challenges out there on getting through the ANEPA analysis and funding that, doing the hydrological analyses and needs analyses that are needed to move these projects forward. And I think has been passed out to you is a letter from Baker County Farm Bureau's President Peggy Brown on projects that they're trying to move forward in Baker County and the challenges that they're facing on getting this pre-planning work done when you're looking at a community that really needs some economic development, and water for most of Oregon is the key to economic development. These projects that we see having opportunity in the state of Oregon are above and below ground storage both. They would be done by individual farmers doing storage sites for their own personal irrigation, along with aquifer ASR technology for aquifer recharge, like Kent Madison's doing in the Echo area, along with water reuse, which Dan O'Brien from Greenberry Irrigation is going to talk about their project with the city of Corvallis. So it's a multitude of projects that we see moving forward, but there is a need on getting the public interest regulations and needs analysis done. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Dan, maybe talk about an individual project.
Madam Chair, Representatives, Dan O'Brien for Greenberry Irrigation.
You can do that. There you go.
How are we doing?
That's great.
Okay. We're currently in the process of going through NEPA right now on a pipeline, and we're going to spend in excess of about $500,000 by the time that process is through. And being about 50 members with a $3.5 million project, this is pretty significant. With that as a background, why we're also working with the city of Corvallis on a water reuse project in which we would move their 10 CFS of treated wastewater down to the district and apply it in lieu of water that we'd otherwise take out of the Willamette. And as we go through the startup to that process, we end up with a lot of upfront costs that will ultimately have to be paid by the city of Corvallis or us. These are relatively new ideas in the state of Oregon without much precedent, and so there's a lot of expensive consultant time and the like that goes into getting these projects moving. I think they're quite important as the TMDL issues arise and these municipalities need some help getting these projects moving. So if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Okay. Any questions for this panel? Representative?
Have you folks talked with the Economic and Community Development Department about the mill? Can you share with us their thoughts on it?
They're actually here today, so I was going to call them up with the Department of Water afterwards.
Sorry.
That's okay.
I'll hold my comment.
Okay.
My question. Thank you.
Any other? I have a question for you, and, you know, for the record, I just want to be clear that I work for one of those expensive environmental planning firms and actually do NEPA and permitting work, so I'm very familiar with the type of projects you're talking about. And question I had is, are there any current sources of funding to offset some of these costs now? I mean, you're looking at the state, federal. Are there other grants out there currently available?
Madam Chair, there are a couple unique things about this fund. To answer your question directly, not really. There are funds available for municipalities through the Economic and Community Development Department, the Special Public Works Fund, Water Wastewater Fund. Those are focused on capital construction. They're really loans to local governments to help them finance those projects over time. The Oregon Bond Bank works in the same capacity by pooling public municipal bonds. There is no fund for private entities, and the federal funds, Community Development Block Grant, and USDA Rural Utilities, also fund some of these municipal capital construction projects are being reduced over time. There is no specific fund for the kind of technical analysis that we're seeking in this bill. Again, what we're trying to do is address that public interest analysis that's required under the Environmental Protection Agency's guidelines, as well as endangered species and so on and so forth. From a municipal perspective, it's the capital construction. You're building something, you have a rate base, and you can sell bonds, pay that back over time based on the revenue source. There is no capital construction revenue source for that upfront sort of environmental analysis.
And if I could add, on the private sector side, the challenge that we face is to get that next step and be able to leverage the capital construction funding, you need to have this preliminary either planning work or permitting work done ahead of time before you're going to be able to access grants or loaning ability, along with, we're looking at several irrigation districts who are at the ratepayer, level, where their individual farmers are the ones funding those projects. And it gets quite expensive when you're looking at several sites. And for those folks to be able to pencil it out before you even get the water to start making, an extra value with the added crops. So,
if I could add also, both the city of Corvallis and the irrigation district have together and separately looked for startup money to fund these sort of pre-project costs, and we couldn't find any.
And just to clarify, and I don't see it here unless I'm just really not reading this correctly, who would be eligible to apply for these grants?
The eligibility is just public or private entities. It does not specify, cities or irrigation districts. It's just public or private entities.
Yeah, Madam Chair, just real quickly, I think that was the point why you don't see it, is because we think both public and private and tribal interests should be applicable to the fund.
And as far as a follow-up on that, for the Safe Drinking Water Fund, which you mentioned and how that's administered, who's eligible for that now?
public drinking water, or Madam Chair, public drinking water providers.
Okay.
Those are the direct loans for improvement to treatment processes, so it's very specific to municipal drinking water.
Okay. Plus, any questions? We'd seem to have lost some of our... So you guys did. You drove away my committee members. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks.
And actually, we will call up... next, I'm going to call up another panel. Phil Donovan, Rick George, and John DeVoe. And then we'll have the departments come up. And I apologize, we have about 7 minutes for each panel, so you guys can duke it out.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Phil Donovan here on behalf of the Confederate Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. As you know, we are very interested in water development, both to resolve the Confederate Tribes Reserve water rights, as well as ensuring good water for municipal and farming interests. As you know, in Northeast Oregon, it's a critical groundwater area, and right now, the Confederate Tribes of the Umatilla are engaged in two very significant projects that could benefit from passage of House Bill 3203. So Rick George is with our Natural Resources Department, and he's here to talk very briefly about those two projects and why we support House Bill 3203. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Smith, hello from home. As Phil said, my name is Rick George, and for the record, I'm representing the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. As Phil said, there are two large feasibility studies ongoing in northeastern Oregon within the lands that are important to the Umatilla tribes. One is in the Umatilla Basin, the other is in the Walla Walla. And each of those feasibility studies is intended to move into a federal water project and go back to Congress for authorization and funding for construction. They'll be large projects. They are aimed at resolving large water supply problems and at the same time addressing critical water needs for in-stream flows for fish, for protection of Endangered Species Act fish, and for moving them off the list, and then ultimately for recovering fisheries, at the same time trying to protect the agricultural economy and the current uses of water. So that's the context for these projects. And one of the criteria now for the Department of Interior and for congressionally funded water supply projects is an explicit state and or other cost share. And this House Bill 3203 is an important beginning for that cost share. It provides an opportunity, a mechanism for cost share that would be at the feasibility study level, that would indicate a strong buy-in from the respective state. Tribes are already doing that, for instance, on the Walla Walla project, and are active in the Umatilla water supply project. So we think this bill is really an important investment in the future to begin the planning process and ultimately to complete the development and construction projects necessary to meet the water needs of the future and address the natural resource needs and the in-stream flow needs for fish. And with that, I'll end my comment this afternoon, and would be glad to answer questions if you have them. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I have one quick question. I just want to make sure, since this lists only just very broadly public bodies and private entities, and public bodies is defined in ORS 174.109, and I'm just looking at that right now to see if tribal governments fall under that. I mean, it's defined, means state governmental bodies, local governmental bodies, and special governmental bodies. It doesn't say tribal governments.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, if I may, you know, we've been in conversations with the proponents of this legislation and continue to work with them to make sure that this legislation, when you're ready to move it, is the best thing possible, and this is something that we can talk about.
Okay. I think that answers my question. So as currently written in this bill, it doesn't cover tribal governments.
It doesn't explicitly cover tribal governments. That's correct.
Thank you. Okay, why don't you go ahead, John, and we'll take more questions.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, John DeVoe, Executive Director of Water Watch of Oregon.
I think your question points out some issues with the bill as drafted, and I would point out that Water Watch has also been in contact with the proponents of the bill. We've been meeting on it, and they seem relatively receptive to addressing some of the concerns we have with the bill. As drafted, we don't support the bill for the following reasons. First, it's unclear, and we don't have data that would suggest that Oregon is in the midst of a water supply crisis. I've testified before this committee about the decline in water use across all sectors of the economy, as documented by the USGS between 1990 and 2000 in Oregon. Also, I've discussed the city of Seattle example, where conservation has turned to be one of the best sources of new supply. We believe that a bill of this type should require study of conservation as a supply alternative and a feasibility or balancing of conservation versus new water storage projects, and it should require a comparison of those methods of reaching the goal, which seems to be to provide more water for various uses. We also believe that the public purposes that I'm hearing testimony about today should be documented in the bill. If this is really about doing projects that are to be environmentally sensitive or to meet purposes such as fish and wildlife purposes, those purposes ought to be documented in the bill, and any studies ought to include those purposes. We also believe that these studies should document the environmental and fiscal issues surrounding these projects, the impacts, the costs, what the returns are on these projects over time, and who benefits from those returns. That kind of accounting needs to be expressed in the planning process for these projects, and this bill, as drafted, doesn't include those requirements. We also believe that expenses for new storage projects should only qualify if the proposed projects would be off-stream storage projects. We hope that Oregon has passed the point of building large new dams on our rivers and streams, and if that's the case, then we believe the bill ought to be so limited. And finally, we question the mechanism of funding here. The Economic and Community Development Department really is not, its mission doesn't include stewardship of water across the state, and we believe that a memorandum of understanding between that department and the Water Resources Department is really too loose of a mechanism to govern spending these funds and continuing stewardship of our waters. So we would hope that that could be tightened up, and we would also point out that the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife ought to have a seat at the table and ought to have oversight of these studies or some input into the results of these studies at some point.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Are there any quick questions, as we still have the two departments to come up? You want to ask the department a question? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, I'd like to ask the Water Resources Department and OECD, Economic and Community Development Department, come up. You can get started if you'd like, Anne.
Thank you. Well, I'd like to have the Water Resources Department start first. Okay. So let me have...
Thanks, Debbie.
For the record, I'm Debbie Colbert with the Water Resources Department, and I'll start with an apology. My director, Phil Ward, is identified on that testimony and was hoping to be here but had to leave. We just wanted to provide some testimony to acknowledge that we like the concept that is provided in House Bill 3203. We think it fits very well with the governor's Oregon Water Supply and Conservation Initiative. It complements that effort very well, and the committee's heard about that in previous hearings. We think that, similar to some of the comments you've heard earlier, that the bill could use some clarification in terms of cost recovery for the two agencies that are identified, and also make sure that that the full range of studies that are needed could be addressed with this kind of funding. With that, I'd just say that we think it does make a nice complement to our supply and conservation initiative, and if funding can be found to support the program, we think it makes sense.
Thank you.
Hello. Chair Dinkfelder, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ann Hannes, acting manager of the Community Development Division with the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. I'm here mainly to answer questions regarding
Yeah, you just have to sit back a little bit. That squeaky, squeaky microphone here.
I think that's me. Keep trying to get it fixed. But.
Yeah, I know.
Regarding administration of funds, we administer 9 different infrastructure funds. I'd also like to suggest some technical amendments to the bill that would be an aid in administering the funds, such as adding a section regarding the uses of the funds so that administrative costs can be used by the agencies to be able to administer the bill, that earnings on the fund, for example, could be used for purposes of the either grants or administration, and that you may even want to consider direct services in lieu of a grant as a possibility in there. Also, I would suggest that OECDD would need to have rulemaking authority on here in order to administer the fund. We'd also would suggest that you might consider a legislative findings section to talk about what you think are the intended accomplishments of making these grants, and that way it would help us in terms of looking at what criteria to use to award the grants. I'd suggest specifying a minimum match in the bill. And then lastly, I know that there was just some discussion about public and private entities, some clarification whether the committee regards them on equal footing or whether or not you have any type of private entity or definition of that you'd like to put forward. So with that, I'd be available to answer any questions.
I think Representative Smith had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I had multiple questions, and you answered all of them except for one.
Oh, thank you.
And this is more of a Ways and Means question. Right now, the Economic and Community Development Department is understaffed in its grant writing, contract writing, and there's a little bit of issue of trying to get the contracts out as quick as possible. What would you see in terms of staffing needs to make sure that the process gets expedited and that applications are moving in a timely manner?
Chair Dingfelder, Representative Smith, I think it depends on one, how many grants are anticipated to be given out. If there's just a few, then that doesn't usually involve a lot. If there's a lot of small grants, and that involves more administration. When we've looked at our different loan funds that we administer, and they're primary loan with some grants to them, our costs have ranged between 3 to 5%. Yes.
Administration.
Yes.
And I just to follow up on that, the points that you raised, and can you put those in? Do you have written testimony?
Chair Dingfelder, I do not have written testimony, but if you want, I could put those points together for you.
That will be helpful. Any other quick questions before we adjourn? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And it looks like there's some work that needs to be done on this bill, so we'll be keeping track of that. And I will now close the public hearing on House Bill 3203 and close the House Energy and Environment Committee. Just a reminder, we do have committee on Friday this week. I know I'm speaking.